If you want to become an actor because you think you're going to be rich, well, there are your odds. You got 3% chance.
You know him as Chris Partlow from The Wire. But Benga's story runs deeper than any script he's ever read.
We grew up in poverty, so that had a lot to do with my worldview as a child. And I was fortunate enough to get out of that environment eventually. I think my parents were doing the best they could with what they had.
From surviving the streets of DC to performing on Broadway, Benga has used acting, activism, and art to reclaim narrative and power.
For the longest time, I was very much wanted two roles, Batman and Black Panther.
On this episode of Afropolitan, we talk Hollywood, healing, and what it really means to play a role on screen and in life.
I don't need to be president. I don't need to build statues. I don't need anything. I just want, even if it's just a handful of people whose lives are better because they knew me.
If you weren't an actor, what would you be?
Benga, so if someone was to watch this interview, what's the one thing you would want them to take away from it?
Ooh. As I'm not sure what this interview is about, I don't know. That's an open guy. That's okay. An open guy.
Okay, we're gonna go into the many, because you have many layers.
Yeah.
I found out about you, so I'm really, really excited to jump in. But I think first, we always want to take it back to your childhood, right? You grew up in Maryland, Nigerian parents. How did they shape your identity and worldview?
You mean my parents?
Yeah, your parents.
It's interesting. So I grew up in Maryland. Yeah. I was born in DC, first generation. I think that, I mean, we grew up in poverty, so that had a lot to do with my worldview as a child. And one of the things I've learned retrospectively is that, you know, children's self, the idea of themselves is established by how the world interacts with them. They're literally learning who they are by how people treat them, what they see, how what they're referred to as. So, which is why it's so incredibly important to like shower kids with love, because like that's how they learn who they are in the world.
Yeah.
And so that wasn't the environment I was in, and I was fortunate enough to get out of that environment eventually. But then, even more fortunate to recognize the importance of not repeating patterns and making an effort to unlearn a lot of things. So, I think my parents were doing the best they could with what they had. But they, those what they had definitely wasn't like the skills to raise children. Yeah.
And I want to also talk about, because you said you got out of that situation. So one of the first things that I found out about you is you got a wrestling scholarship, right? Mm-hmm. Which is very different than the life you live today. So I'm curious, when you got that scholarship, did you have a set plan? Were you very clear, like, you know, I'm going to do this and then go on to that? Or you know, how did you actually land?
Yo, so I was in and out of schools and institutions and trouble up until my junior year. I had earned my way out into what was supposed to be my home school for at least a couple periods. And then I was in the school for troubled youth for a couple periods, and I was allowed to work for do an after school activity, and I did a job. I worked. But because I was in the regular school for a couple periods, I went out for an after school activity for the first time ever, a sport, and it was wrestling. I did well. My coach gave me a pamphlet for wrestling camps that following summer. And these camps were at universities, and I picked one up that sounded like a university I had heard of on television, which is Cornell, and this school was Bucknell. And I called them and told them that I was working, I'd worked, and I was trying to get up there, and they connected me with someone else at another high school, and I got a ride. And like all these things were happenstance. And so then the coach saw me wrestling and realized I had only wrestled 1 year. He then actively started recruiting me. I didn't plan any of that. I didn't, you know, I just, it was different than what I had known. It was exciting to me. It was I didn't have the vocabulary for it then, but it was like good, healthy outlets for young people, which is what I needed. And I lucked into it later in life than earlier. And then when I went back to school my senior year, and I started telling people like, oh yeah, this this about this school and this coach who wanted to recruit me. I didn't know Bucknell was a good school until I started to see white people's reaction. Like, one, they knew it. So I was like, oh, white people know it. And they're like, oh, Bucknell. I was like, oh, white people like it. And so I'm like, then I started to look and I realized it was a good school. I didn't plan that. I was very fortunate. But I put my teeth in it. And I wasn't going to let go because I didn't have a plan B. Like, once I graduated, I was out of that house as far as, like, they pretty much told me when I'm 13, you leave. You will not be here. And so I'm like, all right, well, I have to figure something out. So.
And was that where you started to understand more about acting, or did that happen like way after you finished university?
Way after. Like, okay. So when I graduated, and I ended up working for the federal government for a year, and I got curious about acting. You know, someone came by my cubicle and mentioned that they had a friend in town who was acting, and I never even thought of it as something that someone did as a career. It was, television was my babysitter. I watched hours and hours and hours of it growing up, but that was about it. So then I started researching it and started submitting myself to auditions in the DC area just to see what it was like. And it was nerve-wracking. And I got a thrill from it. So I was like, I want to do more. I want to learn more. I want to learn what a monologue was. I started going online and just, you know, doing research. I bought a bunch of books. I was excited.
So I want to call out Chica on something. So I'm a huge Wire fan, obviously. Like, I rewatched it. I think like maybe even a month or 2 months ago, I literally watched it again. Mm-hmm. There's just so many nuggets as you grow that you just keep picking from it. You know, Chica's never watched The Wire.
I've watched episodes of it. I've never watched the full thing.
Yeah, you can't, that show.
But she's also from DC and the DMV area, so I'm like, this is even double.
But I'm not from Baltimore, so that's a mistake. You can't watch a lot of people.
Episodes because you have to watch it all linear. You're not from where you're from.
I'm from Germantown.
Oh, that's right. Which is definitely not Baltimore. She said, that's the tagline of Germantown. We're not Baltimore.
I'm a white picket fence. Like, that's the type of, where like.
You go, Seneca Valley?
Funny enough, that was my rival school.
Really?
I went to Northwest.
Northwest?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, you know.
She said, I grew up in suburbia.
Yeah, that all Germantown is that.
So The Wire has stood the test of time, like 20 years later. What do you think made the show so special?
I think it was a confluence of a few different things. One, the writer. Mm-hmm. The writers, you know, led by David Simon, Ed Burns. We also had novelists who were also like part of that team. So it wasn't just like writers. It's like people who understood story in this long form and deep characters. Dennis Lehane, Richard Price. We had like amazing writers. I think also we were Baltimore. We weren't shooting in LA or New York. We shot on the streets of Baltimore with oftentimes using real people. And we were telling full stories, not just caricatures. And funny enough, so we were, you know, the show never won, you know, any of the big awards. It actually wasn't really nominated. And so year after year, it was ignored. And then there'd be a slew of writings in articles and newspapers all over by the critics about how crazy it was that this show was ignored. But what it did was kind of bond us. Like, we realized, oh, we weren't doing this show for the industry. We weren't doing this show for the viewers, because we didn't really have a lot of viewers when we were on. It really blew up after the fact. We were doing it for us. We were doing it for Baltimore. So we just like got to like stick to true storytelling. And there were no precious cows. Is that the term? Precious cows on the, like, they would, anybody could get it. You know, they, so even if you were a very popular character, like the writers didn't care. Like, what was the most important thing was the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which ended up giving so much credence and credibility to what happened.
You know, it's funny, as I rewatched it again, I remember your character, Chris Partlow, when it showed up on screen, I was like, yo, it's the beautiful aspect of this character is he communicates in so much body language, where he uses his words, but you also can read his body language if you're somebody who's perceptive, right? So how did you prepare for that role?
I started killing a lot of people. Oh, is this on? Are y'all recording? I thought this was the before the recording. You have to erase this story.
No snitching on set.
Yo. You have to see them all as full characters. Yeah. You have to see them as, you know, they have wants and desires. And not playing a bad guy, not playing a good guy. It's just a guy, it's someone who has a job, someone who has responsibilities, yeah. and being true to that. And then realizing that you just put these people in different circumstances, mm-hmm. you know, then you have your story. Mm-hmm. Like Chris could have been, like Marlo and Chris could have been like, you know, CEO and COOs of like big companies. Yeah. Like Marlo was brilliant and Chris is the way his mind operates as far as operations, you know, but they were born in Baltimore. Yeah. They were born in the life they were in. And so seeing them as that, I think that's that for me, as far as approaching it as an actor, seeing every character as a full person, yeah. whether it's on the script or not, you know, it's your job as an actor to make that person a full person. Yeah. Is a good place to start.
I think some of our viewers would like to even understand more about the business of Hollywood, right? Comparing when you first started in the industry to now, mm-hmm. how has the industry evolved? Whether it's like the Hollywood strikes just happened, mm-hmm. right? How would you say the industry has evolved, even from a payment structure perspective? Are actors treated even in a better way today or no?
Evolved or devolved?
Devolved.
Yeah, because I want to talk about that. Like, yeah. do you feel like it's the industry has moved forward or it's mm-hmm. been in this like cyclical movement?
It's a strange time, as you both mentioned. To be frank, like the industry never made sense. Like I'm very fortunate. I've been able to do what I've been able to do for as long as I've been able to do it and make a living. You know, like we're in an industry where 3 to 5% of the people work. You know, which is wild. That isn't any industry like where that's the, you know, those are the numbers. That's not necessarily sustainable.
Sorry, what do you mean 3 to 5%?
Like, so of like SAG members, like okay. have like jobs enough to feed themselves and
year round.
Year round. Yeah, it's great. Yeah, I was like, people don't realize that, you know? And, but we still keep plugging at it. We're passionate. We love these things, what we do. So if you want to become an actor because you think you're going to be rich, well, they're your odds. You got 3% chance. Yeah. I mean, that's not even rich. That's to like
pay your
bills regularly. Exactly. Yeah. The industry was like, and then like in the 90s, 2000s, these conglomerates bought out the studios. So the studios became just a part of a much larger, you know, someone's portfolio. And so you make decisions differently when one is just all business people running things, but also it's just part of a portfolio. It's not necessarily to make the most creative material or reach, you know, audiences desperate for to see the stories represented. It's the bottom line. We've been seeing the fallout of that. Then the writer's strike. And AI, it's into these are changing times. I liken it to when the the music industry, then when that shifted, and, you know, you had records, you know, people would buy records, you know, then you had DVDs, people would buy DVDs, and like they went digital, and it never went back. Like things are, you know, music doesn't sell the way it used to sell. They had to find different profit models, and then artists had to definitely like really really start to look out for themselves.
Yeah.
So,
but what would you then say like the advent of the Netflixes, the Disney Pluses, I think some people in emerging markets like maybe Korea or even Nigeria will say, hey, Netflix is now giving us a platform to be able to get some distribution to the rest of the world. Whereas before, where was a Hollywood studio going to come and find like mm-hmm. some of these films? So would you say in terms of trade-offs or balance, the streaming platforms have been net good or net bad?
I would say, that's a great question. Mm. I would say like South Korea and Nigeria, like you said, like these stories are able to get out, which is great because these aren't new. We've had these stories for a long time. We have news like there's so much bubbling from Nigeria and Korea and other places, and so these streaming platforms have given a platform for it. I would say it's a net good because we get to tell our stories and see ourselves represented that way. The adjustment of it, the industry, it's been painful. because, you know, you have the old model, you had this interim model that never like fully was flushed out, but it worked for a few powerful studios. And then online came and just like, well, you know, now what? So, and then you find, then retroactively, we find out like streaming didn't work the way we thought it would, or the way the studio thought it would. So they've been bleeding for years now. So it's, but this, you know, disruption happens in all industries. It's about that figuring your way out and surviving, you know, until things settle.
Did you ever worry about ever being typecast after The Wire? Was that something that even, or were you just like, look, I'm even happy that we're here. But was that a worry you had as your career evolved about being typecast?
No, because I knew, like, I love acting, but I didn't love it enough to take anything that came my way. So I'm like, nah, after The Wire, I was presented with a lot of opportunities that were kind of, you know, lesser versions of that, you know, of, you know, Chris, he's a criminal, he's a killer, this, that, whatever. And the writing was not. And so I said no, but I also love to do theater. So I didn't depend fully on just like film and TV. So if there weren't like TV shows or films that I thought really dug, then I would, you know, try to, you know, jump into a play and just really, you know, dive in. And there's a ton of great plays.
You know, growing up as Nigerian kids, sometimes even in the diaspora, even first generation immigrants, you're pushed into certain career fields, right? And sometimes it feels like your parents only become proud of you when people are now saying, oh, this is what your son is doing, or this is what your daughter is doing. What was that transition like? And not just even with parents or family, but even friends, when it's, you know, Chris is on this show, and this show is literally today called the number one show in TV history, and that's Benga in the show. So what was that transition like, having to navigate those maybe perceptions that people might even have? First dealing with they're proud of me, to now maybe sometimes it transitions into something else that you might not necessarily be comfortable with. But what did that look like?
It was good, because as I mentioned, I was in and out of a lot of trouble growing up. So, you know, they had a different perception. And then as you change your life, you know, they're proud of you, which is great. You want the people in your life to feel, you know, good about you and your outcomes. I think, but like most people that see people on TV, I think they have a certain understanding of what it is, you know. I won't name any names, but I'll tell a story.
Tell a story, yeah.
So I gave a gift to someone in my family. It was like, you know, I live in Brooklyn, and we have really cool, like, I do my best to support like Black businesses, and there's like some really cool, you know, arts and crafts and businesses. And I gave a gift to someone, and they looked at it, and I'm like, what? Nothing. And they looked at me, and then they go, oh, millionaire. I didn't understand what they're saying. I'm like, what? Oh, millionaire. And they said, oh, millionaire. Millionaire. I said, why do you think I'm a millionaire? The internet says you are a millionaire. I was like, and just like that, I can't give gifts. Because like, the internet says like the gifts I should be giving, because I'm some multimillionaire. It should be this. I was like, so I'm like, all right, this is, like, that explains why I've been getting treated this way. Y'all think I'm doing y'all dirty. Yeah, yeah. And so I'm like, so.
You out here giving thoughtful gifts, huh?
Yo!
Not Snapchatable gifts?
No! And I asked, like, what would be a gift that you would like? A Mercedes.
Small Range Rover now. Let's Rover little.
Let's range a little.
I was like,
okay. I'm like,
oh God, our people, man.
I drive a 2010, and that'd probably be the last car I ever drive. Yeah. Like, I'm fine with that. I don't need a new whatever.
Yeah,
you know. So yeah.
They're like, just because you're humble, don't mean we gotta be humble.
Yeah. And so you know, there's some of those changing perceptions, and you know. And juggling responsibilities, like we grew up poor, so and a lot of that is like the mentality that is poverty, like wealth and our mentalities. And so those things were instilled in us. And I remember when I started working for the government, I was making like $300, $400 a week. And I'm like, I'm going to do different than what I've seen. So I purposely went to go get books to learn something different than what I'd seen my parents and my elders do and so on. And I realized then that it's not about how much money you make. It's what you do with that three. I'm like, oh, let me do something with this $300 a week. And that's what I started doing. When I try to explain that to my family, it's like, it's not, I could give you this dollar, or we could sit down and talk about, you know, your debts, your issues, your problems, whatever, and figure out a plan. And if I give you this dollar, you could maybe spend it for what you say you're going to spend it for. Yeah. But now you don't have it. I don't have it. So, you know, or we can talk and communicate and have some real like heart to heart and then make a plan together. And then I can show you how this dollar can like serve us both and still be here. Right. Give me the money. Why do you want to be my business? So, yeah.
So I would like to talk about, you've done theater, film, and television, right? Mm. And I think a lot of actors don't do all three. So I'm curious, what do you find as different with the different mediums? Like, how do you prepare for each type of role?
There's the obvious where, you know, television and film, you're playing for the camera, so it's smaller. It's about your relationship and communication with the other actors in the scene and the director and the writer. Like, in theater, it's in the end, it's like, it's you and that audience. Mm-hmm. And like, no matter how much you rehearse and so on, it's the piece isn't baked until you start to run it in front of an audience and you get to do it night after night. And, it's difficult. It's very difficult in live performances, which is why I love it. It's like, it sharpens you. It's like, if you fail, you're going to fail big, you know? And so, because you're in front of a live audience, it's not another take. And that affects your work. And it's also a collaborative form, you know, platform. So a medium. So I like that. I like learning from the choreographers. I like learning from the other actors, the writer, and so on. Being in the room if you can with the writer. So those are some of the ways they're different.
And would you say you enjoy one medium versus the other? And do they serve different creative needs for you?
Great question. I get something different. Yes. Well, I think one answers the other. I enjoy them all differently because I get something different from them all the time. Theater, it really pushes my craft. And it makes me, especially since I get an opportunity to do it again and again. And I have a live audience that I'm working with. It really hits differently. So I love it because of that. Television and film, because like, it pays the bills, you know, theater doesn't pay the bills. But I've also been fortunate to get to do like some really good TV and film. I just did a movie with Kathryn Bigelow. It's the second time I've worked with her. She's an amazing director. And just to see her work and to see, you know, the stories that she tells, and particularly on the scale that she tells them, it helps inform my work. A show that I was on called The Old Man on FX and Hulu. I mean, that was such a, like, felt such like a ridiculous situation for me to, like, I'm like working with John Lithgow, Jeff Bridges, Amy Brimmerman, like all these like amazing, like this is, this, and then me, you know, and then the writing's great. And it's shot so beautifully, and FX is just like letting us do our thing. And the support we got from FX and Disney, especially during COVID, because the show ended up being like taking many years to shoot because of all the shutdowns. You know, it was great. It was great. So you get different things from, and get rich off it, but it's one of the best experiences I've had.
Mm. Yeah. And speaking of, you know, all the different types of mediums you've done everything from big scale productions, Wire 24, to little, like more like independent productions, right? Would you say that you have to change how you approach the roles depending on the scale of the production?
Ooh, that's a great question. How I approach the role? Not necessarily. I mean, so like the bigger productions have more support for the actor. And when the smaller projects, you know, because you have to, you know, you don't have as many resources. You do have to, like, you know, fend for yourself. But as far as approaching the role, I think it's pretty much the same.
Mm. And is there ever a role you take and you cringe after you watched it? You're like, ugh.
Well, that's not necessarily fair, because I cringe after, like, everything I've done. I can't watch, like, I haven't seen a movie I've done in years.
Mm.
Except recently, I was made to watch something that I recently did because of the Q&A. I had to, you know, sit there. They're like, no, you're going to sit here because it's a Q&A after. You've been faking these other Q&As. You're going to watch this one. And so so there are some projects that I never talk about. There are some of those.
He's going to keep that in the tuck.
They're all learning lessons, you know, all learning experiences.
Yeah. You appeared on Dr. Phil to talk about the Billy Fallon case.
Billy Allen,
sorry. Mm-hmm. What led you to get involved in that particular fight?
A friend of mine reached out to me that this family, you know, Billy's sister, Yvette, and Billy, they were looking for any help that they could to kind of bring awareness of Billy being in prison and being innocent and so on. He's been in prison now the majority of his life on death row. And so I started talking to them, and I was like, I want to help. What little I can do, I'll do it. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, I don't care if he was innocent or not. I don't think the state has the right to take a life. And he happens to be innocent. So I've been working with them for years now, and we've had some amazing progress this past year. And Billy calls me up from death row every once in a while. We just talk. It's the people on this campaign, like his sister's, like, dedicated her life to this. And there's a woman named Whitney Yang, but it's Billy who's running this campaign, and like the way his mind works, and he's running it from death row. And so, like, we go out there and we do the things we can, and like, he's got some really great lawyers who are, you know, been fighting this case, and we're raising money currently right now for a legal fund for some moves that need to happen soon. It's been interesting, especially with the transition in administrations, because the previous administration, we spent a lot of time trying to get Biden's attention to give a pardon. He submitted his pardon application and so on. And now, like, things are you have to understand the administrations you're appealing to, and so the moves are different. So it's been, I've learned a lot. This is the first time I've worked on a case like this, particularly for as long. But like, Billy's my friend at this point. And I was like, now it's about getting my friend out.
What would you say you've learned about the criminal justice system in the U.S.? Obviously, being Black, we know it's not necessarily always the fairest to people who look like us. But what are some insights that you've learned where you're like, wow, like, this is either messed up, or I didn't even understand the intricacies of how this, like you said, with different administrations, you have to approach it differently. With Biden, you might need to appeal to something else. With Trump, probably need to appeal to something else. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the things you've learned about the criminal justice system?
It's working extraordinarily well. Mm-hmm. As in, this is what it was designed to do.
Yeah.
It's us who have the illusion that it's about one thing when it was never about that thing, like justice. It's a tool, you know, to exercise power. If you go into a courtroom, you know, where you're supposed to be represented and your rights and, you know, as a citizen. But the truth is, when you're in a courtroom, you have no power. You have no power. Like, whether you're convicted of a crime or not, you speak when they tell you to speak. You stand when they tell you to stand. They tell you who can represent you or not. Like, all those things. It's their interpretation of your rights and so on. And all that bleeds into, like, an outcome. Particularly if you are of a, you know, from a quote-unquote minority group. And we've seen it now, like, so blatantly, like the injustice that comes from the criminal justice system on a very small level like, and we and where they say it's all good as far as all equal, we see it on an international scale with like the complete obliteration of human rights, of the world order, as far as how, you know, the international courts are supposed to work. Everything that they tell us is, as far as, is this is how the world works in a fair way, or this is how a fair world works, and we all subscribe to this, is complete BS. Like, yeah. We've never sent a U.S. president to prison. You know how many people, innocent people that we've acknowledged that we've killed, and then no one goes to prison? We created Guantanamo. We tortured people, put them down there, and there are people still there, and they realize a lot of them didn't do anything. You know, not that torture is actually legal, even if they did do something, you know, and no one went to prison. You know, so and all the decision makers are, you know, they all happen to be from a similar class, race, and gender, you know, speaking in general, and they don't go to prison.
Yeah.
So when you show that, when you continuously rip up the social contract and then expect people to, you know, adhere to the social contract, there's a dissonance that you know makes you Nimrod. It makes you crazy. So it's why, like, Black folk live, like, the lifespan is less in the United States.
Yeah.
You know, your genes and your perception, everything, your body's telling you this is unfair, but then everything around you is telling you you're crazy, you complain too much, we've given you so much. Didn't Lincoln free you?
Be grateful,
you know? So I say all that, like, to, you know, to scale it from what's going on with Billy to what's going on with Congo and Gaza. It's like, these things would never happen in white nations. You know, like, you have leaders who've actually said, you know, The Hague is meant for African leaders. They said it.
Yeah.
You know, that's how much they believe, because they're so irate that anyone would even question, you know, white led nations, you know.
Hey, look at how they responded to Ukraine. You know, everyone's like all in opera, like, yo, yeah, let's come together, let's do this.
Yeah.
You know, I would say, what informed your thought process behind being against the death penalty?
It doesn't work.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it's purely to satisfy the drive for retribution from a bloodthirsty community that feels like it's been violated, which, yeah, is understandable, but it doesn't actually work as a deterrence. So why are we doing it if it doesn't work? We say to deter others, but if it doesn't work as a deterrence, then, and we still keep doing it, then that's not logical. And the truth is, like, we do it because it makes people who've been violated feel better. But I think we should act in ways that, like, the best ways that help the community. And if it worked, if it helped the community move on and grow, whatever, and, like, lowered crime, like, there would be an argument for it, but it doesn't. I also don't think that human beings have the right to take a life. You know, I you know, outside of, like immediate self-defense, I don't think human beings have a right to take a life. And so, and just because the state does it, that doesn't, like, actually give a right. And so there's that. I think it's as simple as that, you know. And I find that the more, I mean, obviously in prison, I mean, in the United States, we imprison more people than anyone, right? And yet, like, crime is extraordinarily high. I always tell people, like, particularly Nigerians the worst things I hear about Nigeria comes from Nigerians. And, like, you do realize the United States probably kills way more people than Nigeria. And as far as also dying on a, like, you know, average out in a year. And so we have to really put it into perspective, you know. And I don't just mean as far as death, you know, death penalty. I mean, as far as, like, our actions and so on. I just don't think we have the right to do that.
Yeah.
And I'm also curious, what prompted you to start getting into activism, right? Was it that you saw some grave injustice? Was it, you know, something you read? Was it something that's always innately in you? What prompted you on this path?
I think that I developed the words and understanding for this in retrospect when I looked at my own life. And I thought, like, oh, wow, that was a lot harder than it needed to be, or a lot more complicated, or really unjust, as far as my childhood and the lives of my family, my parents, and so on. And I'm like, well, and then I start questioning, well, how did it get that way? Why did it get that way? You know, and then I realized, oh, these systems were set up way before, you know, and there's they continue that way. And then you start questioning, because most people don't question systems and the ways we live. We just think, these things are around because it's obviously the best. It's after years and years and years of human evolution and so on, it's been distilled to the best forms of how to operate and how to move. No, but we make that assumption on a deep level, but that's not true. It's really powerful people who hold on to the control and the means of production and so on through their powerful families generationally, and that affects and creates governments. That's it. And so it's not too unlike like religion. You know, it's like, you know, some people decided this as opposed to that, and all of a sudden we have the gods they gave us, you know? So when you think about, okay, well, these things were created by people, even the bad things, that means that, hell, I'm a person, you know, maybe I can do something about it. You know, these are people, maybe I can work with them, you know, to do something about it. And then you look and you realize, oh, wow, there are people throughout history who they don't necessarily teach us about every single day, who said we can do something about this and change. And some of them even did it. And so that encourages me.
And I want to, you know, because you talked about, you know, how you grew up. And I'm curious, your acting has spanned over 20 years. Is there one lesson? I know, right? That, I looked, I was like, woo, you a veteran. You OG.
they call you Unc?
I'm one of the young ones. It's me and Boyega out here, right?
But I'm curious to understand, is there a lesson you wish you knew earlier in your career?
Oh, that's a great question. These are all great questions. Is there a lesson that I wish I knew earlier? No, because I know everything. No, I'm just kidding. Earlier in my career, that I was more self-possessed as an artist. I feel like we get trained to feel so grateful, so lucky, you know, and obviously we are, but we also don't advocate for ourselves because we fear being like exercised, you know, and out, or, you know, taken out or not given opportunities and so on. And what's how that ends up manifesting after years is that we are, you know, for the most part, like largely underpaid compared to our white counterparts, particularly if they have a fraction of our careers. The studio's own value, like I can't tell you how many like Hollywood execs, like they who actually believed, like, oh yeah, black movies, the black leads, black superheroes, that no, that doesn't, no one show up, no one show up, then like Black Panther, billions of dollars and so on. It's like, yeah, because the audience is there, and it's global, and it's not just black folks. And if you give the people, you know these things, they will enjoy. But if you also, you know, train and show the people that these things are valuable, they are, you know. So I would, to answer your question, I think I just understanding my value more so as an artist at an earlier stage.
And looking ahead, are there any stories that you want to tell, right, or maybe should be told? And are there any types of roles that you actively still want to do?
Yeah, there's a lot of stories. There's some that I'm developing now and pitching. For the longest time, like, I was very much wanted like two roles.
Okay.
I mean, like, there's a lot of great roles out there that I'd love to do, but the ones that I wanted like very much so was Batman and Black Panther. Jigga, what?
I see it though.
You know, and I remember when they announced that, because they've been trying to make Black Panther for years. I mean, decades. I remember when they announced that, like, Chad, you know, they're going to make it, and Chad was going to be the Black Panther. I was shooting a TV show. I had like all the SWAT gear on me. I was shooting The Following, which was fun to do, and I went outside. I sat down on the corner and with this big rifle in Brooklyn, like, and I'm like, and I was like, oh, for a second, I was like down because like I wanted to do that. It's one of the roles I was like working towards, hoping for. And then I got excited because it was Chad. And I knew Chad. I loved Chad. Chad was a good dude. And I was like, oh, this is one of the rare times Hollywood gets it right. Mm-hmm. As far as like a good man getting a role that's like, he was already doing well, but this is like, I was like, yeah, good. That dude, run with it. I knew he would. So that I was excited for Chad. And then, the world got to really know, they knew his career, but like with, you know, after the Black Panther, they realized, oh, this guy is a great human being.
Yeah.
And so what his friends had already known. So, which was really cool.
Actually, speaking of this might be a controversial question, but I see this all the time as a debate on Twitter and threads around sometimes when Hollywood wants to put in place a, let's say they're doing a Nigerian person, like literally the person is playing a Nigerian, mm-hmm. and they tend to get people, they say from UK, right? Do you have any thoughts around this? Like, there seems to be this big debate around why can't they find actors in America or in Nigeria to play certain roles, or even if it's a Black character, a lot of times there's African-Americans that feel, I don't know if it's threatened or frustrated that they tend to get these people from the UK. Is there any thoughts around this?
You're right. This has been a big thing in the diaspora for a while, in the artistic diaspora for a while. And I've had like some casting directors, you know, explain to me in the UK and in the United States, explain, and producers, I would tend to agree. So you have actors, you know, like in many different countries. There's only a few though, as far as countries that where the acting's already kind of like would like go right into what like Hollywood produces as far as style, temperament, and all that stuff. And the UK is one of them. There's not a union like there is in SAG, as there is in SAG, with SAG, and so you have basically a talent pool that's pretty good that you can pay less, and that's the simple calculation as far as these studios, and then they'll come and they'll knock it out of the park because they're, you know, for the most part great actors, and then they'll become stars in the States, and they're you know, their quotes go up higher and so on. And then after a while, they're expensive, like a lot of American actors. And so they just get more UK actors and start the process again. So obviously there's been some, as you mentioned, some, you know, some people who are not happy with that, especially when like some people have noted, like, oh, you're going to take these UK actors to play these Black American historical figures, you know, when it's not their experience. Some folks have been upset with that. I think it's a victory when any Black person works, particularly in Hollywood. And I don't care where you're from, but I understand that, like, that then the how some people were upset by that.
Yeah. So we're about to go into our rapid fire.
You haven't segment. Already started. I haven't started.
This one has been, so what is it called?
Softball.
But before we even go into that segment, I wanted to ask you, because we were talking about therapy earlier. Mm-hmm. What has therapy meant for you, and how did you even get into that? Like, what was the decision as a Black man to say, hey, I'm actually going to explore therapy? Because, and the reason for this is, I want us to both, this might be helpful to other Black men who are considering going into therapy. So I wanted to just understand, like, what are your feelings around therapy, and how did you also get into it?
So I've had an interesting journey with therapy. It started with, you know, me as a youth. And so there was like court ordered therapy and court ordered, you know, psychologist evaluations and all this stuff, and court ordered medication and psychotropic drugs and so on. And then the institutions that was sent away to, and I didn't want any of it. Like, I didn't want to be a part of it. None of it got to the root of what was, you know, what was wrong. And that's out, you know, a stable, safe place to be a child. Yeah. So there's that. But as I got older and I became more self-possessed and started to really like do my own work and read the things I like that spoke to me. And then I really valued therapy and being able to do it in a way that's like, that isn't just about processing me through a system that was never designed to for me anyway. That's the, you know, it's only designed to tear me apart. So I love therapy. I love therapy. I love my therapist. I love you. And so the cornerstone of me, who I am. And I recommend it to my friends all the time. Like, and so much so that I'm sure they're like, you sound with this therapy. Yo, you're talking about therapy.
It's a buzzword,
you know,
now.
Yo, it's real, you know, just, and it's seen as this new age thing, but it's not new age thing. It's a substitute for what we used to have in communities. It's a substitute for what we for these outlets that we used to have as far as like relationships with people, you know. And as those pillars fall, you know, the need for them don't, you know. So we act out. We don't know how to, you know, get what we need, right? I think a good example is rites of passage. So at least in the States, like, which is a culture based in capitalism, like, there's no such thing as a rite of passage. Every culture, you know, has some sort of version of that, in which you help a young man and a young woman, a boy and girl learn what it is to become a man and woman in their society.
Yeah.
And with all the raging emotions and feelings and so on, like that type of guidance, you know, that the testing, the Maasai's like go out there and hunt, you know, they come back and whatever and survive, like the testing of who it is. And then you've learned who you are and what you are meant to contribute. Like that is crucial in growth. And when you take that away and then you have like all these young people, you know, who are like just trying to figure out who they are in understandably violent ways, because, you know, adolescence is a violent time internally and externally. And if a society doesn't understand that and just, you know, punishes them, you know, take these drugs, get locked up, whatever, like you have what you have in the States.
Yeah.
So, but if there's guidance, someone to talk to and help you, like just kind of walk through your thoughts and emotions and not judge you, like it's amazing what can be. And it's and understand this is just temporal. Like this period, this even your depression, it really is just temporal. Your, you know, your paranoia is just temporal. Just someone to help you understand that it can save a life.
Yeah. Mm. I agree. All right, so we're gonna go into a rapid fire segment.
That wasn't it. I'm
sorry. You said you don't like to watch your own movies or your shows, right? So what's your favorite show that's not obviously a show you've been in?
Oh, I loved Game of Thrones. I loved Breaking Bad.
Real name.
Yeah. Yo, I love those shows.
best. So what's your favorite movie then?
I mean, there's so many great movies. I don't have a favorite movie, but one of them up there is definitely Goodfellas. Mm. Yeah. It's damn near perfect film.
Listen, you hitting all the right be normal.
And I do love a Princess Bride.
Okay. Okay. Yes. Okay. If you weren't an actor, what would you be?
Wrestler. I love wrestling. I miss it every day. I mean, I probably would have aged out. Definitely would have aged out at this time, but I would have been wrestling the past few years. Wrestling or writing.
Okay. What's a role you
auditioned? Not WWF wrestling role.
Yeah, I was about to say, maybe want to be WWE. Yes.
No.
John Cena?
No. like Olympic wrestling, yeah. International competition, real wrestling.
Yeah. Okay.
I feel like I knew that that's what he meant, but you have to clarify these
you
days,
have
though.
To now. People are like, where's your mask? I'm not, no, I don't wear masks.
Black Panther.
Yo, that I would don a mask for.
Awesome. What's a role you auditioned for but didn't get that you still think about?
Ooh, I usually move on. Mm. Funny enough, there's the Jackie Robinson, like, which is what, you know, there was the thing that kind of blew up Chad.
Yeah.
And he went on a roll after that. I'm like, I wonder if I had booked that. I said, I could have come into that audition differently and so on. So like, I haven't thought about it in years, but I did think about it for a while. I was like, ah, so that could have happened.
Wait, but I'm curious, after you don't get a role, do they normally give you feedback?
The industry's changed. I used to get a lot more feedback, which is great for an artist. But some artists don't want it. I get it. And like me, I like to understand. But it's, I get not so much anymore. But I'm appreciative when people take the time to give feedback.
Yeah, that's very good.
And I want to understand, lastly, right? What legacy do you want to leave? What do you want people to remember Benga for?
Maybe your father has the answer. He's like, how do you fix that? take these devotional. that he gave more than he took. And that like people's lives were better because he lived. Like, it seems like a simple thing, but it's also a large thing. I don't need to be president. I don't need to build statues. I don't need any. I just want to like, even if it's just a handful of people whose lives are better because they knew me, like that, if it can be more, great. But if it's like five, like, cool, this life was worth it.
I love that. And we always ask each guest, who do you want to see on the Afropolitan podcast? Like, whose story are you like, I want to know their story?
Uncle T. No, I'm just kidding.
Don't get us in trouble, though.
I want to know his story. I would like to see. I want to stay away from all the politicians on the continent, because there's a few that come to mind. There's a couple, and I feel bad because I remember her name is Krista, and I think her husband's he's a chef, and they're on Instagram. Like, they're a black couple, and they have a huge following, but they you guys mentioned you troll each other. They troll each other.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and she's always about. Like, and she's also like always doing like flips.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like,
I know what you're talking about.
But they look like they have a lot of fun. You know, obviously it's the Instagram representation, but I love that they even like they spend so much time with one another, even just creating content. They have kids, whatever. I'd love to see the two of you talking to them.
Yeah.
Ooh. Yeah.
Okay, hey. I like that. Yeah. We'll make it happen.
Right. Double click into it.
Yeah, slide into their DMs.
Well, thank you so much for being with us here today. I really, really appreciate you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, Benga,
for feeding me afterwards.
We feed people on the Afropolitan podcast, guys. No. There's food. You will not leave here starving.
Not even Fox does that. I'm just kidding.
thank you so much, bro. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for inviting me. Thanks for having me.
Of course.